When injured vets return to the U.S., their first stop is the Walter Reed Army Medical Center. Today's improvements in tanks, body armor, and medical care have led to more soldiers surviving their injuries than in previous wars. My next guest, Colonel Paul Pasquina, is the medical director of the amputee program and chairman of the Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation at Walter Reed. As Jonathan Cunningham discussed in the first part of our show, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency has many projects underway that are making it possible for Dr. Pasquina to give his patients more advanced artificial limbs so they can lead more normal lives. This past weekend, Dr. Pasquina was given a Lifetime Achievement Award by Country United, a joint effort of the Henry M. Jackson Foundation for the Advancement of Military Medicine and the Tug McGraw Foundation. Well, Colonel Paul Pasquina, welcome to Fresh Air. Let me ask you first, do the advances in battlefield medicine mean that you have more seriously injured soldiers coming in to Walter Reed and people with more amputations?
Well, I think there have been dramatic improvements in the survival rates of injured combat service members that have been recognized in operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. Primarily, we have the most highly skilled medics that are in the field providing first aid, life-saving treatment, as well as expert field surgeons, anesthesiologists, nurses providing combat casualty care. So the survival rates of this conflict have been unmatched in history. But as a result of that, we do see a number of injured service members that are surviving wounds that would not have been survivable in prior conflicts, which has created significant challenges, obviously, for our medical professionals, but more importantly, challenges for those service members and their families for recovery.
Have you seen noticeable improvements in prosthetics just since the beginning of the Iraq War in 2003?
There's no question there has been a significant improvement in the technology that exists for care for individuals with limb loss. There had already been a significant movement in terms of development of lower limb prosthetics, in terms of materials, in terms of energy storing capabilities, and socket design to make a more comfortable and functional lower limb prosthesis. There had not been as much advancement in the upper limb, and with the challenges that we were seeing for our injured service members with upper limb loss, we felt it very important that the Department of Defense and the Department of Veterans Affairs invest a significant amount of money towards research for upper limb prosthetic development.
You know, I've read that there's something called a C-leg. That's not S-E-A. That's the capital letter C, which is, I guess, includes some battery-powered joints. Can you tell us about what that is?
Sure. There are several microprocessor knees that are on the market, produced by various prosthetic companies. And what a microprocessor knee does, it has a computer chip that controls the resistance of that knee to either flexion or extension so that it actually can adjust the resistance based on your cadence or your speed of walking so that when you're walking faster, it will provide less resistance. When you're walking slower, it will provide more resistance. So it works by the knee adjusting to the speed of an individual's ambulation.
And it can tell when you're going uphill or going downhill too, I guess.
Well, there are various components that that can help with yes, adjustment up or downhill.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies sitting in for Terry Gross. Back with Colonel Paul Pasquina, medical director of the amputee program at the Walter Reed Army Medical Center. He talked about some of the challenges researchers face in developing artificial limbs that function more like real arms and legs.
What we see is the next great movement towards improvement or technology development in lower limb prostheses is development of power. You have to realize that all lower limb prostheses that are available today, or at least the majority, are passive devices, meaning that they don't replace the muscles that are lost with an amputation, so that you have to actually support the entire leg and swing that forward or backwards. The introduction of motors into a prosthesis will actually help propel an individual either out of a chair, up a flight of steps, or, you know, forward during ambulation. So we see the future of prosthetics incorporating more motors to replace some of that muscle loss. There are two powered knee devices, one that has been on the market, one that is now coming to market, that does offer some great advantages to that, that still need to be evaluated and still need to be developed. But we see that as a potential great advancement in lower limb prostheses.
Tell us about artificial arms. What's the type of artificial arms, wrists, or hand devices that you can put on, and what sort of functionality do they provide?
So for the individuals that we see with upper limb loss, we typically start them on what's called a myoelectric prosthesis, so a motorized prosthesis that works on sensors over the muscles that will pick up on muscle activity and then cause a elbow to flex or extend or a hand to open and close.
And that's a muscle in the at the end of the residual limb?
That's correct.
Yeah, okay.
Our approach to that is because we believe it's very important to get an individual using a prosthesis as early as possible to help with their rehabilitation and recovery. And because we believe that bimanual activities will help preserve the intact limb over the length of an individual's life, so that if you just resort to using one hand all the time, then you'll have an increased risk of developing arthritis or overuse injuries of that remaining wrist, elbow, or shoulder. So we believe that's very important. And the reason for our choice of a myoelectric prosthesis often is because of the extent of injuries that we do see with combat injuries. There is oftentimes significant soft tissue injury or skin injury that prohibit the use of a cable-powered system that would put more pressure or more strain on that limb.
So the myoelectric prosthesis is one which has batteries and which attaches to the vestigial limb, the stump, if you will, and it has electronic sensors which detect muscle movements and convert that into digital signals and actually make the fingers move, the wrist turn?
That's correct. It makes the hand open or close on demand, elbow flex or extend, and then the wrist rotate if a wrist rotator is added. And what that allows us to do is actually train an individual with limb loss before their residual limb is even able to withstand a socket. So before a limb is even closed, you can put these electrodes on their muscle, get them to start driving prosthetic devices and exercise those muscles before their limb is even ready for fitting for a prosthesis.
And then what's the next step?
So then as they learn how to use that prosthesis, then we also introduce a more traditional body-powered prosthesis, which is controlled by movements of either the shoulder or upper limb to pull a cable system to either open or close a hand device or a terminal device or an elbow, which is the more traditional type of prosthesis. And we are very fortunate in the Department of Defense to provide both a myoelectric prosthesis as well as a body-powered prosthesis to all of our individuals, and so that they can decide which one is more functional for them. So when they're going through the rehabilitation process, oftentimes it's not clear what their long-term goals will be. So while they may prefer a body-powered or a myoelectric prosthesis now, as they move forward with their either returning to active duty military service or returning to the community, they may end up using one prosthesis more than another prosthesis, depending on what profession they go into.
So they may walk away with two in the end. Yeah,
that's correct. And we also do also provide activity-specific prosthetic components to allow them to get back to the activities of their choice. Again, whether that be weightlifting, whether that be basketball.
Can you describe one or two of these activity-specific components?
Sure. So for an upper limb amputee, there are various terminal devices that will fit whatever that activity may be. So if that activity is hunting or shooting, then a different terminal device will be used than perhaps would be used for rowing a boat or scaling a wall during rock climbing.
My understanding is that historically, GIs who have suffered amputations have generally left the military. That is changing, I gather. Is that right?
That's correct. We have seen about 20% of our injured service members with limb loss that have gone through the medical board process that have decided to and have achieved going back to active duty military service. So there has been kind of a cultural shift in terms of opening the door for our injured service members to return to active duty service. We have to be careful in our approach to that. Obviously, our goal is to help our injured service members return to their highest level of function and return to the goals that they set. But many enter military service wanting a military career, and we're very, very happy to be able to provide that opportunity for them.
Do you get to know the patients individually yourself?
I get to know many of the patients. I wish I could get to know all of them, but I do get to know quite a few, yes.
Is there an example of one who came in maybe in the depths of despair with an amputation that you can recall changing when they were fitted with a prosthesis and were able to restore some of their body functions?
Well, there's no question that we see a significant amount of tragedy in the work that we do. But I think the tragedy we see is far outweighed by the inspiration that we all feel seeing our service members and, again, their resilience and courage that they demonstrate. Watching somebody get up for the first time out of bed after they've been on prolonged bed rest for multiple injuries is always an uplifting experience, as well as watching individuals that have come through a long rehabilitation process that have now moved on with their lives and their career, have gone off, gotten married, had children, either returned to military service or returned to education, and then come back to Walter Reed or Bethesda and talk to some of our newly injured service members, because their telling of their story and the path that they've carved, I think, opens up doors for future veterans.
Well, Colonel Paul Pasquina, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you.
Colonel Paul Pasquina is Medical Director of the Amputee Program and Chairman of the Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation at Walter Reed Army Medical Center.
At Fort Hood today, among the 13 people who were honored in a memorial ceremony were several mental health professionals. Commentator Heidi Kraft is a former Navy psychologist who served in Iraq, and so she's very familiar with the struggles and stresses of that work. She says this is a moment when caring for service members is as important as ever.
We sometimes don't sleep very well. Our vigilant ears scan the night for those distant booms. We lie awake amid the roar of helicopters overhead, wondering if they'll be landing at our pad. Because when that happens, we are roused loudly by pounding fists and voices shouting about mass casualties. They demand that we sprint out of our cots and across pitch-black clearings. And then we move through a chaotic mix of scrubs, desert utility uniforms, IV bags, stretchers, and wide, fearful eyes. The next morning, sometimes we scrub blood off our boots. And then we trudge through the sand to those small, hot spaces where we provide care all day, where we listen with empathy to our patients' stories of trauma, fear, friendship, loss, and loyalty. One day, the deployment is over and we come home. We struggle to reintegrate into a stateside life from which we often feel disconnected and distant. And once we've taken leave, we return to our jobs at the hospital. On that first day back in clinic, we have 8 new patient charts waiting in our inboxes. And we listen, with empathy, to our patients' stories of trauma, fear, friendship, loss, and loyalty. We are the mental health providers of our uniformed services. We chose our lives and our professions. And we are dedicated to our work and well-trained to perform it. We put our patients first, in the desert and at home. and sometimes our patient's trauma is similar to our own. Coupled with the exhaustion that comes from feeling empathy for people who are suffering, shared trauma takes its toll. But we try to stay the course, alongside our stateside counterparts who also endure the compassion fatigue of treating combat trauma. And together we turn our feelings inward, sometimes neglecting our own needs and continuing to care for our patients, regardless of the cost. The tragic events at Fort Hood last week, in which 13 innocent lives were brutally taken, allegedly by an Army psychiatrist, had nothing to do with us. Mental health personnel struggle every day to break down the walls that have historically created a frightening and intimidating prospect in our armed forces. That is, the seeking of treatment for invisible combat stress injuries. I hope that the impact of one suspect's heinous act will not lead those who need help the most to find one more excuse to avoid it. But today I am sure of one thing. The Fort Hood community, the mental health community, the Army, the military, and our country will grieve and pay tribute to the lost and begin our collective healing. We who have been entrusted to the mental health care of our warriors and their families will be there to help. We always have been.
Dr. Heidi Kraft is a former Navy psychologist. She's the author of Rule Number 2, Lessons I Learned in a Combat Hospital. She has been called the most dangerous woman in China, and she wields her power with words. Hu Shuli started the Chinese business magazine Caijing 11 years ago and built it into a formidable institution. It's run investigative reports that pushed the boundaries of press freedom in China, reports on corporate fraud, but also on matters beyond the world of finance and economics. After last year's devastating earthquake, the magazine ran a lengthy expose on shoddy school construction. Earlier, its reporters examined the government cover-up of SARS. Well, yesterday, Hu Shuli announced her resignation from Caijing. Dozens of other staff have left, too, in a power struggle with the magazine's owners. The New Yorker magazine's correspondent in China, Evan Osnos, profiled Hu Shuli earlier this year. He called her an incurable muckraker.
During the Cultural Revolution, she was a Red Guard, and like a lot of young people, she was sent out to the countryside. And for her, she told me that that changed her conception of what was possible in China, and she realized a lot of the flaws in the state-run economy. When she came back to Beijing, she studied journalism and steadily emerged as a very influential investigative reporter. And then when China started to open up the economy in the late 80s and 90s, she positioned herself so that she would become basically the chronicler of that experience. She started to get to know a lot of these very prominent and promising young finance officials who eventually became the people who run China's economy today. They run the central bank, they run the stock exchanges, and they were her friends. And so that gave her a very important insight into the way that China operates.
How popular is Caijing, this magazine in China? Who reads it? How widespread?
Caijing is very influential in an important community in China, and that's essentially the educated class. It has a circulation of about 250,000, but that doesn't really express the impact that it has. If a piece appeared in Caijing magazine, you could be sure that it was being read by people in power, and that gave her a certain amount of power and capital, but it also made her vulnerable if those stories made people angry.
Well, why did Hu Shuli resign from the magazine that she started?
Over the last few months, Hu Shuli had been coming into greater conflict with the organization she created. She had decided that it was time for Caijing magazine to grow and to become something more international. And to do that, she needed money and she needed political space. To get the money, she needed the publisher to support what she was doing, and she wanted them to invest more into her magazine. And then she needed them also to protect her when she strayed into sensitive territory. She was encouraging her reporters to do more and more aggressive reporting, and that meant that her publisher needed to spend the kind of political capital to make sure that these stories didn't get censored. And eventually her publisher decided that it wasn't worth it for them. In part, it started to fall apart this summer in July during the riots in Xinjiang province when a Taijing reporter had a run-in with a police officer. And in the end, that incident blew up into a sort of larger conflict between the magazine and its authorities. And she parted ways on Monday.
Have you talked to her since then?
We've been in email contact.
What does she tell you?
Well, she said to a lot of us that she's planning to start a new magazine. At the moment, she is taking a new position as the dean of a journalism school in Guangzhou. And a lot of her senior deputies and most loyal editors are in Beijing beginning the preparation for another publication. So there's a lot of us that will be watching what that becomes and what it means for the future of Chinese media.
Do you think she'll run up against the same limits that she found with Caijing, or does this open up some new horizon for her?
There is a big question mark now about what Hu Shuli is going to be able to accomplish in her next publication, if there is one. And that's because what she's been able to do over the last 11 years at Caijing is a reflection of two very specific things. One, her own grit and aggressiveness and acumen. But it's also been a function of the fact that she had an influential, well-connected publisher, and that publisher was able to protect her when she got into sensitive territory. In her next publication, we don't yet know if she'll have the same combination of protection and energy. She'll be the same, but we really don't know what the circumstances will be.
Evan Osnos, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Evan Osnos is The New Yorker's China correspondent. We were talking about the Chinese journalist Hu Shuli, who resigned yesterday from the influential magazine she founded, Caijing. The Jewish holiday of Purim arises from a story of Jews in ancient Persia as told in the biblical Book of Esther. Now the novelist Deborah Spark draws on the same story for her latest novel. It's called Good for the Jews, and it's set not in ancient Persia, but in Madison, Wisconsin. Alan Chews has our review.
Here's a smart, sprightly, sex-drenched, and neatly plotted novel about Midwestern life set in Madison, Wisconsin. It's got a beautiful 25-year-old, inexperienced Jewish woman as its main character, some steamy sexual situations, and a broad swath of serious political concerns about mid-sized city bigotry and the dangers of know-nothing bureaucracies. From its provocative title onward, the novel moves steadily along with credible and often compelling characters, never averting its eyes from the betrayals and hypocrisy that make life in any town a laboratory for the study of contemporary American mores. For a small city, Spark writes, Madison offered a lot, anchored as it was by the university and the state capitol building. Still, it might have been another country, the doughy citizens at the farmer's market who hawked their wares, promising cheese curds so fresh they squeaked. Out in the suburbs, towns were dotted with ugly statues of wee people, little elves or trolls. For San Francisco-born and raised high school history teacher Moe Scheinbaum, the older cousin of Ellen Hirshhorn, the, for a while at least, virginal main character, living in the Midwest is like living abroad. When Moe's reckless but successful teaching style leads him into a confrontation with a hard-nosed high school principal, the Jewish educator finds himself in a lot of trouble, which is eventually brought to a boil by cousin Ellen's romantic involvement with the superintendent of schools. Anonymous letters, missing files, vague threats, a synagogue fire, and a death followed by a suicide. All this contributes to a superb, sometimes satirical, always cutting investigation of the way we all live now. East Coast, West Coast, or Third Coast.
Good for the Jews is the latest novel by Deborah Spark. Our reviewer, Alan Chews, teaches writing at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia.
Now it's time for Back Talk, where we lift the curtain on what's happening in the Tell Me More blogosphere and get a chance to hear from you, our listeners. Lee Hill, our digital media guy, is here. Lee, yesterday we talked about the horrific discovery of 11 cadavers at the Cleveland home of convicted sex offender Anthony Sowell. We talked to a local NPR reporter covering the story and a city council member who represents the area where the bodies were found. Lee, you blogged about this. What are listeners saying?
Hey, Michelle. Well, people are shocked, first of all. And after the initial horror fades, the questions start pouring in, such as why police weren't drawn to this scene earlier. Well, here's a post from blogger Sean. I'll read it. The attitude of police in the minority community is a large reason for the multitude of questions this crime has generated. Perhaps this may be time for police departments nationwide to rethink the way the minority community is policed.
Thank you, Sean. And of course, we'll bring you more details out of Cleveland as the story warrants. Now, on a completely different note, last week marked a full year since the historic election of President Obama as the nation's first black chief executive. We acknowledged that milestone last week by asking a panel of political thinkers to reflect on Obama's presidency so far. Here's a clip from that conversation with conservative commentator Lenny McAllister, who calls himself a hip-hop Republican.
I don't think he's lived up to a lot of the promises that he said that he was going to do, one of which was take us to a new post-partisanship and post-racial America. That was a lot of the promise that he campaigned on. We've seen racial incidents jump up to a rise in a level that we haven't seen in a long time, and it's been a crescendo.
Lee, as you know, several people took issue with that assessment. We heard this from blogger Rosie, who posted online.
Obama was elected 1 year ago. He has not been president for even a year yet. How can he be blamed for the increase in racial incidents? I'm so disgusted with everyone who's attacking him. The right will trash anything he says and does.
Thanks, Rosie. And speaking of performance, Michelle, in your commentary last week, you weighed in on the dust-up surrounding President Obama and whether his penchant for sports activities outside the Oval Office unfairly excludes women. Here's what you had to say.
I think that this obsession with including women in Obama's every waking moment, including his sports outings, just perpetuates a different kind of bias, the bias of a jockocracy, where facility with sports somehow has some relevance to how well you do your job. Unless you're a personal trainer, I don't see how it does.
And Michelle, looks like you weren't the only one frustrated with the dialogue. I caught up with blogger Alex, who agrees. Here's what he had to say.
Why is it that in the United States, every single detail is overanalyzed, always from the perspective of discrimination? Can boys just play without someone coming along and labeling the entire thing as discriminatory or racist or this or that? I, for one, would like to have President Obama play basketball with me and my buddies, but that doesn't mean that I'm sexist.
Alex, you don't want me to take you to school right on the court. I guess I'm not being invited. All right, Lee, any updates?
Yeah, just one, Michelle. On Friday, President Obama extended that $8,000 tax credit for first-time homebuyers. Now, we reported on this the other week. The provision was supposed to end December 1st. The extension pushes that date back to June, but in order to take advantage of the credit, a mortgage contract must be signed before April 30th with a closing date before June 30th.
Thank you, Lee. Planning to buy anytime soon?
I don't know. We'll see. We'll see.
And remember, with Tell Me More, the conversation never ends. To tell us more, you can call our comment line at 202-842-3522. Please remember to leave your name. You can also log on to our website where you can read more from fellow listeners and enjoy a simpler social networking experience. Just go to npr.org, click on Programs, then on Tell Me More, and blog it out.